Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
Before we get into this week's episode of Small Doses Podcast, want to let you know that there is no bonus episode of the podcast this week. Why? Because your girl is taking a mental health break. Yeah, I know. I can't even believe that I'm doing it, but your girl is doing it. So this week I'm offline. I'm not doing anything extra that I don't got to do. And it's not that I don't got to do the bonus episodes, but I mean, it says bonus for a reason. So I'm sure you all understand and I truly appreciate it. If you don't, maybe one day you will. Actually, maybe you won't understand because you won't need to take a mental health break, but baby, it's necessary for your girl. So, want to let you all know that. Also, want to remind you that you should go to amandaseals.com and sign up for my newsletter because I just announced tour dates in Boston and Baltimore in May. And I know you want to be there. So make sure that you go to amandaseals.com and get your tickets. And remember, we are going to need to go grassroots, y'all. They are shadow banning me, echo chambering me. I mean, they're doing all the things to me on Instagram. And so I'm relying on you all to spread the word amongst your folks, old school style. Hear it through the grapevine. Tell your friends at brunch, at church, at the club. Are y'all still going to the club? Tell your friends in your group chats. Spread the word when you see my posts because really, they're trying to stop a chick from moving, but they can't stop it when I got the people. As Ossie Davis once told me to my face, never stick your neck out deeper than your feet are rooted in the people, and my feet are firmly planted, and I know y'all got my back. So make sure you go to amandaseals.com, sign up for the newsletter so you can make sure that you don't miss when I'm coming to your city, and go to amandaseals.com and get your tickets. I'll also be in Dallas. That's happening April 12th, 13th, and 14th. I literally changed the date so they didn't fall during Ramadan since we have such an Arab audience that is now joining in at my shows. That being said, I know that y'all are going to check out the Amanda Seals show. If you haven't signed up for Patreon to join the SEAL squad, then baby, I'm telling you, you about to get in on some goodness because we are leveling up the Patreon and it's happening very soon and I cannot wait to see you guys. Last but not least, got to remember that Small Doses Podcast video episodes are no longer available in full on YouTube. I know they are on Patreon though. So if you really loved watching Small Doses, then all you got to do is go to Patreon and check it out. All right, let's get into this next episode of Small Doses Podcast with yours truly. Bye.
Small doses,
self-help from the hip.
Small doses,
we're talking that shit.
Small doses,
and keeping it real.
Small doses,
with me and them seals.
It's so funky.
I did not know until, what was it, last week or 2 weeks ago, you posted that you and David Johns were friends.
Yeah, we went to Columbia together.
I had no idea. And I saw you hop up on him in that video. And I was just like, of course they're friends because good people find good people.
Good. Everybody knows David Johns, though.
Yeah.
Like, that's not, like, that doesn't make me, that's not unique. Everybody knows this man, Moni. I'm surprised you don't.
He's okay. Just good people. And the Birmingham, Alabama me doesn't let me call many people good people.
Alabama?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm from Opelika.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Yeah, that's my home.
Yes.
Like, everybody who knows me knows I'm from Birmingham because I bring it up all the time because I feel like Black folks, that like, I tell people the best way to describe this is I did not grow up with whiteness as an aspiration at all.
Like, that's what Charles Blow always talks about, that he grew up, like, outside of Baton Rouge, maybe, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, I never had like whiteness as a beacon.
No.
Like, I grew up around all Black people.
Yes.
The doctors, the teachers,
lawyers,
the politicians,
my principals,
yeah.
So when people have the story, and I didn't realize how foreign or rare that was. And so, like, I go to college and I'm around a whole bunch of Black people who are used to being the only smart Black person. And I'm like, oh, I was in gifted classes with Black people. My AP chemistry teacher was a Black man. Like, you know,
right.
It's just a very different way of being. But it also impacts the work that we do at Surge because so many people have been told they have to leave aspects of who they are behind in order to be respected, promotable, whatever. And it's like, no, that's bullshit. They want you to leave your power behind.
So the podcast has started.
Oh, has it?
because that right there is a great way to jump us off. Because to be honest, that's not a norm.
It's not.
And then you have educators who didn't live that norm. And so they are also going into the education system already drained before they get there.
Absolutely. And they're feeling like they have to show up in a certain way. I have to shed aspects of who I am. And usually those aspects are the things that make you uniquely qualified to connect with young people and their families and see their beauty, their assets.
But wait, let me pause you right there. We're going to run it back real quick because I just realized we got so into the conversation that I didn't even let y'all know I am with Carmita Simon. Okay. The founder of the Surge Institute. The Surge Institute, I learned about when I was really given a great opportunity to come and speak at your, is it an annual?
It is biannual.
Okay.
Biannual
like
alumni
conference.
Convening. Okay. And you killed it in that room of 250 people. Yes, you did.
Thank you. I had the teachers laughing. You know, it was really dope just to be in a space of educators because I really like that is one of my passions is like always platforming education, educators. I like every other smart Black person knows that education is the key to liberation.
Absolutely.
And you got Baldwin on your earrings. So we already know where you at with it. And I find there's like these pockets of dopeness that I only find out about simply because like I may get to ask to speak at the event or, you know, sometimes people will be like, oh, you know, can you promote this thing? And I just, what you all do in terms of lifting up Black, Brown, and Indigenous educators and taking their already leadership instinct
yes.
and enhancing it, creating momentum behind it, and really pushing it forward is a thing that I think a lot of people don't realize needed to be done.
Absolutely. And I mean, so first of all, I want to say dopeness attracts dopeness. So the reason that you find out about stuff like Surge is because you're dope.
Thank you.
So specifically, when I founded Surge, so we're talking like 2012, 2011, I'm shopping this idea around. And at that time, I was saying, look, we can't keep talking about education as the civil rights issue of our time without acknowledging that the people leading this movement are not the people who are suffering the injustice.
Right.
And while everybody might be, you know, super woke now, in 2012, when I was saying this, I was called a reverse racist.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yes, ma'am. But fast forward, here we are, 2023.
So wait, someone fixed their face and like said it to you?
Oh, yes, yes. So let me tell you, this would need a whole podcast to talk about founding an organization that is investing in our people, wearing this skin and being unapologetic about what it means to, and I think you said this right. We always say we don't groom leadership. We invest in people who are already brilliant.
Yep.
Like we invest in the genius and brilliance that already exists within our community. Now, what we're trying to do is provide additional opportunities, skills to elevate, amplify that. We're helping people connect with people across the sector that they might not have ever met
mm-hmm.
in ways that we hope catalyzes collective action and great outcomes and opportunities for our young people and families. But that was just over 10 years ago, not a super, you know, accepted thing to say.
Mm.
People said, yes, they fixed their mouths to say you're a reverse racist. They were also like, this is a really great idea. How about you go work for fill in the blank to build this out? Now, fill in the blank, I don't have to tell you who that always was, right?
White people?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Because
how about you go take your idea to these white people and go under their leadership?
Yes. The irony of that, like, I think it was lost on people when they suggested that. But here's the thing.
You know what, though? People are lost in general. Like, I just am, because you're just really realizing, like, y'all really don't understand what race is. Like, y'all really don't understand, like, the immensity, like, how it fits into everything we're doing. Like, it's must be nice.
Even, and here's the thing, the beautiful thing about our people is, and I think the more proximate, I say this all the time, the more proximate you are to an issue, like you are going to see things that other people just don't recognize because they're not there. So when you're trying to solve a problem that people don't even recognize exists, On the one hand, you've got an uphill battle to get people to understand why it's important. On the other hand, and I'm, you know, I'm always the person that's also going to talk about the opportunities this provides. You can kill it. Like, people had such depressed expectations of what Surge could be because they didn't understand the demand that already existed within our community. I tell folks, particularly folks of color who are starting nonprofit organizations, every one of the first investment checks that we received from large education funders for Surge was a one-year investment. They were like, oh, I call them nuisance checks. They were like, okay, here yeah, you go. Right. Like,
it's really just, here, nigga, damn. That's right. Actually what it is. Here, nigga, damn.
Exactly. Yeah. Here you go. Here you go.
It's Carmita calling us again.
Again, because I'm relentless. That's Birmingham, Alabama in me. And every single one of those investments turned into multi-year, in many cases, multi-million dollar investments.
But why?
In part, because our people showed up. Even before we had a name, I didn't have a brand, I didn't have anything. Mm-hmm. All I did, and starting in Chicago, was to say, we are seeking educators, people working in the field of education, who are folks of color, who know that they actually want to have an outsized impact for our people, but don't have places that are pouring into them.
Okay.
And with just that, no brand, barely a website, all of this sort of stuff, word of mouth, we had like 10 people for every one slot that we had apply for this program. And then just based on that first cohort experience, you had people who came out of that saying, this experience is transcendent. You have actually changed how I see myself, and that allows me to change how I operate in this space. So for us, this isn't just about leadership development. We talk about it as leadership acceleration, because what we're doing is head, heart, and spirit work.
So tell me a bit about your past in terms of how that allows you to know what you need to pour into folks, right? Because like you said, like your proximity to something is going to be able to inform your ability to identify like what's missing, what is needed. And so like, tell me about like how you got to this point. Because when people are saying that I was transcendent is, that's like a revival.
Yeah. So I'll start with Birmingham.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't grow up in a place like Birmingham as a little Black girl without innately understanding your brilliance and your genius, because you see it in everyone.
I gotta tell you, I don't think that that's like a normal attribute that people apply to Birmingham don't know about Birmingham.
Because most people, when they see Birmingham, they think of grainy black and white photos and Bull Connor's dogs and all those things, right? Which is also true.
Right.
Like, the trauma of all of that is very true. But what people don't understand on the other side of that is what came out of that was this heroism and this like bold, audacious black leadership that was like, we're here. And I think I'm a generation removed. I'm a 70s baby, right?
Yep.
So I was a generation that was then being raised by these folks who walked with that boldness and that audacity. So I, you know, grew up in a very black place, but I was also in gifted and talented classes and all these other sorts of things that people often associate with being white dominated spaces. But that wasn't my experience. So I read Autobiography of Malcolm X in my gifted ninth grade English class that was being taught by a white man in Birmingham, Alabama. Like, that was just my reality.
So, like, you know, I feel like a lot of our Black community ad hoc is like really wooed by money and by the access to whiteness in a way that undermines our connectivity to each other, right? Like, I'll never recover from the fact that, like, the entire NFL didn't kneel with Colin Kaepernick. Like, I'll just never recover from that. Because it was like, this is so obviously, like, y'all have the power. Like, all of it here.
Yeah, so it's
like, odd to me. But I know that it was because it's like, well, no, because if I do that, I might lose my opportunity.
Yeah.
But what you're describing in Birmingham, it's like, culturally, what is it about Birmingham that you feel like made folks be like, we need each other in order to have strength? Because I think that's not necessarily the case in all Black
absolutely.
In all Black communities.
Well, so I want to say two things. One is, and this could be a whole other podcast. Now, what I was very keenly aware of was being poor in Birmingham. So class was something I was very aware of.
Okay.
Now,
okay.
I was the kid who grew up in the projects. Me and my mom were homeless for a bit, like da-da-da-da-da, all
right,
that stuff.
Right, right.
But I was also an amazing student. I did school well.
Flex.
And so...
just a little slack.
Flex. But to be clear, I had the kind of Black mama who was like, I'm sending you there for your schooling, not your education. So at home, I was reading Mansa Musa.
Oh.
I was reading James Baldwin. Like that... That
I
was
see.
My,
okay.
that, so, wow. so I just, I want to say that I don't want to paint it as some like utopia that didn't have, like, let's be real.
Right.
But I think there was something, and if my auntie was sitting here on this sofa, she would say that in many ways, segregation was the best thing that happened to Black folks in Birmingham.
Okay, so that's what I was going to get at, but I didn't even say it explicitly, but like, okay, so literally, like someone was asking me the other day, Amanda, like, what do you think it would take for Black people to support each other again? And I'm like, we'd have to be forced to. That's what I think it would unfortunately, sadly take. It would require us being forced to have to lean on each other
mm-hmm.
in order for us to see each other again.
Yeah.
And here your auntie. Gosh,
oh,
my,
oh
darn
Auntie
it.
Bunny, she has said it many times. Now, it has caused arguments in the family. Folks are like, of all the things, we think that's the best thing that happened to us, segregation.
Not but, the, but I know what she means,
yes,
though.
But it was effectively like, because we all lived in one neighborhood, we all went to the same church as schools, like you had the doctors and the
it
lawyers.
It was de facto community.
Yeah, absolutely. And so while that was not my experience, like I did, you know, I grew up, again, a generation removed. So people who had means had started to move to different places and all that sort of stuff. That mindset and that mentality was something that was absolutely poured into me.
McDonald's is not new to chicken. So maybe stop questioning their chicken cred and get your hands on the McCrispy. Juicy fried chicken, buttery bun, unmatched pickle to chicken ratio. Yeah, they know what they're doing. In fact, we can honestly say they're not new to chicken. They're true to chicken. The McCrispy. Only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
You know, Black media is really its own unique space because the Black existence, particularly in America, is its own unique space. And even as we are watching that erasure and the legislative effort to undermine the necessity to be literally intentional with making spaces for Black people in a country that was very intentional and continues to be intentional in keeping Black people out of spaces of equity, we know that Black media has to be on top of that. We know that Black media has to be able to speak to our unique existence. So when it comes to the next generation of influential Black voices, I'm really happy to see that they can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black stories, Black truths. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story, but now they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. So hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcasts that center Black voices. It's NPR Noir. Turn on NPR today and hear a range of voices as varied, nuanced, and bliggity Black as the country we reflect. Stories should never be about us without us. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
And so when you then went into the professional world,
yes.
How did that, because so, I feel like that's
oh
how you
goodness.
Get the high sedity.
Hold up. Let me tell you, okay.
This uppity Negro.
Well, okay. So I've had many great fortunes. What I will say is
nice.
I started my career as a chemical engineer. I worked for Procter & Gamble, but I worked in Albany, Georgia, or Albany, as they would call
Albany, Georgia.
Albany, Georgia. So I worked with a ton of Black engineers. Like, they were actually very intentional in recruiting from HBCUs and local. So I had a community of folks who were my people. And nice. I also had leadership that allowed me. So I was a chemical engineer, but education had always been in my heart because, frankly, education was my pathway out of poverty. Nice. So I started looking for opportunities to volunteer in the community, partnered with this local high school to actually support their students in math and science to get them ready for their graduation exams. Mm-hmm. I was able to get other Black engineers to join in that effort.
Nice.
So what I'm saying to you is, like, this has always been who I am. I then decided that I was eventually going to pivot into education and in nonprofit because I didn't want the thing that I felt like was my calling to be the thing that I did on the weekends and that sort of thing. Mm. But before I made that transition, I will tell you a very specific instance of when they realized I was perhaps a little too Black for them in the space because I didn't—
And who's they?
They, I won't name—
No, I'm just saying,
company,
like, is this a chemical engineering?
This is a company that I worked for before I made the transition into education. And while I was at a big seminar kind of thing, I'm the only Black person in senior leadership. Mm-hmm. And someone, a white man, decides to make a few comments to me. It started with a little benign, oh, you gonna eat that chicken? You know.
Mm-hmm. So why are we protecting them?
Wait.
I hope you have a lawsuit.
But let me tell you. So it went, if I'm calling—
This is in Albany?
No, this was actually outside of Chicago.
Well, Chicago racist AF. Right.
Well, you know. So if I'm calling that benign, just imagine how much it escalated. Now, I never reacted to this foolishness.
Are people witnessing this?
Yes. So people are witnessing. Other colleagues are witnessing this happen.
These are other Black colleagues?
These are white folks. Okay. I'm now in a place that's majority white. I'm the little token chocolate chip. And So this man is making these comments. I don't say anything because I already know how this is going to roll, right? So fair. I'm like, okay. But I am watching these colleagues and they don't say anything.
Huh.
But by the time we get back to the office on Monday, they clearly have been sending— this is BlackBerry days. They clearly have been
on
their BlackBerry. Like, yes.
Because
as soon as I got there that Monday morning, our president calls me in and he says, oh, it's come to my attention that some horrible things were said to you. Da 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 da. They presented me with this letter that they were gonna send to this man to say all this, right? And I said to him, and I was maybe 26, 27 years old at the time. Mm. I said, I really don't care what you do to that man because, you know, your problem is not him. Ooh. He's one random racist man.
Right.
Your problem is a culture that actually allowed your entire staff to witness that and not step up and say anything.
But then they say it to each other.
Oh, exactly. Now, I was 20. So to bring this back to Birmingham, it never occurred to me not to say that. It never occurred to me.
I know this, like, life. Yes.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Like, it never occurred to me to not be that person. And that's because of Birmingham. Like, those are the things that I feel like folks give me lots of credit. I hear all the time, like, oh, you're so courageous. Oh, you're this. And some of that might be true, but I'm also pretty naive to other things that people think are risky. I just... You know, I just don't give people that much power over me. And I think when folks allow other people to wield that kind of power, they subvert themselves in ways that I think diminish their own power.
Yeah, I have no idea what that's like being in Hollywood. I mean, honestly, that is very telling of just, like, not only the kind of person you are, but also just what you understand, like, work to mean, right? Because, like, so what was the repercussion of you saying this at work?
So there was nothing happened. This guy got some letter.
Oh, so they did send the letter.
Oh, yeah, they did.
Okay.
Because effectively what I now know is they were trying to make sure I didn't sue. I wasn't smart enough at the time to think about it. I could have sued. I mean,
I hear this story so much. We never think of going to HR.
It was really like, hey, at this point, I already know I'm leaving this place.
I had
already planned an exit strategy. So I'm like, I'm already out. Mm-hmm. And what I'm going to do is leave you with some truth. Whether you choose to hear it or not, that's up to you and the rest of these people in this organization. But I think what was more powerful is just being unafraid of just saying it. And
right.
recognizing that, like, what's the worst you can do? Like, fire me and I can get another job.
So in that, when we talk about restoring Black educators, I feel like so many Black educators don't feel that way. Like, yes. they actually don't feel like they can say what they want to say, and they yeah. don't feel like they can just get another job. And so it does become a very, like, draining experience. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, yeah.
Because I have folks in my DMs like, girl, thank you for saying the things we can't say.
Yeah, and I mean, here's the truth. Sometimes they're right. They can't say a thing, right? Like, yeah. especially if you're operating in these spaces that are extremely litigious and all this.
Yes.
And let's be real. A they lot of us in. Are carrying the weight of families and other people on our backs. Yeah. Like, you know, the thing that I felt super comfortable saying at 26 and 27 when I didn't have a mortgage or a child or whatever might be slightly different now. So I just want to own that and
Absolutely.
Say that as well. So what we're trying to do is create space for one, like, we often say we hold up mirrors. We want people to see themselves. We want people to return to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Because this isn't about just getting a bullhorn to say any and everything. We want people to actually lean into the things that really matter to them. And you can't do that if you've been wearing a mask for so long that you don't remember exactly yeah. what matters to you in the first place.
Right.
So a lot of that heart and soul work is about getting people to tap into their own version of authenticity, not authenticity as a brand, because right now that's what it starts to feel like, honestly.
Definitely.
But I say to folks all the time, my greatest hope is to help people learn how to navigate spaces without being corrupted by them in order to dismantle them. So
like, what are some tips?
So I think
tips and tricks.
I do think that you have to learn what matters in your space. Like, what is success measured by? And for a number of our educators, that's like, okay, it's not just student impact and student scores and all those other things. It's like, how are you actually engaging with the broader community? How are you making families feel? All these other sorts of things. But you can do that in your own way. And what we're often, you know, actually helping our people to do is learn their own gifts and strengths and talents, and think about, don't follow a cookie cutter approach that generally is what some white person has cooked up in the background. It's like, hey, you can get to those same outcomes using the things that are unique to you and the people that you embrace yeah. and pour into. So that's part of what we're doing. We're also, if you ask me my passion, another one of my passions is creating safety nets. But mm-hmm. I like to think of them as trampolines instead of safety nets because we see so many other people fail up all the time.
Yes.
They make missteps.
Yes.
And next thing you know, they're in this better, higher paying job that's got broader, you know, I'm sure you've seen that. Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always flabbergasted, right? Like,
yeah.
I just really, because it ends up being like, oh, this is their redemption route.
Oh, absolutely. And here's the thing. If I had an unlimited pot of money,
okay,
right? Like, one of the things that I want to do is create the space for people to really push these systems to change, knowing that you're probably going to lose your job at some point, right? Like, if you're doing this and you're doing it for real, then two things have to be true. One, you have to be building a bench behind you. Like, because
okay,
if you're
yes.
going to really push the system, you got
to
actually have
to be
some
able
people
to.
Behind you so that if and when you do have to make a choice that's like, hey, I'm going to say or do this thing that I know may get me pushed out, mm-hmm. but it's okay because it's not about me.
Right.
It's about this work. And if I fill the pipeline of people,
there's someone to take.
Right. But then it also requires that on the other end, you've got someone or some institution that is invested enough in you that one failure or whatever won't be fatal.
Mm.
And it actually helps to propel you to whatever is the next thing. Now, that's like
the ideal.
Right.
I was like, that's the vision.
That's ideal. That is the vision. And in some cases, I am really proud of the fact that we've had people who have like pushed the envelope and then we've been able to help them start their own thing, right? It's like, hey, what you're trying to do isn't going to fit within a system that was never designed to do that thing.
Well, I'm curious about like, what are some of the things that folks come to you trying to do that you feel like you need to restore in them for them to get to do
it? Yeah, it has run the gamut. I'll use an example. One of our early fellows was working inside a large urban school district. I hate that I just said large urban, but that's what they call them, but you know what that means.
I understand.
Anyway.
Big and black.
And brown in this case.
Philadelphia.
So I was working in a large district, has a data background, like data hungry.
And what does that mean?
Was interested in how to use data to tell stories
about. Got it.
And what students weren't being served, what the data is telling about where we need to like have more resources, how we need to help educators, all that stuff. And was trying to do this within this large system and was meeting roadblocks, you know, because that's what systems do.
Yeah.
And so as a capstone project, because everyone who does Surge does a large sort of capstone or Freedom Dreams is what we call them project to solve some problem that they see within their organization or broader community. And this person actually founded an organization that now, fast forward, that was 2015. So 8 years later, now employs over 20 people, are working internationally.
Oh, wow.
I think they're on their second round of VC funding. I think they're, I don't know all the corporate terms, but raising millions of dollars, capital, to actually support educators and systems of education to leverage data to do the right thing for students and families. And that's a great example of, this is a person who came to us. He was already brilliant, already had this idea, all of that. But recognizing that if you continue to meet roadblocks in the system that you're in, nothing says that you just can't build your own shit.
Like, right.
And here's what we're going to do. We're actually going to connect you to people that can support you in doing that. We're going to help build your skills around how to write a business plan and a financial model. We're
foundational stuff.
Exactly. Because so many of us, like so many of our brilliant ideas die on the vine. Not because we're not entrepreneurs. Like our whole community and existence has been built on hustle culture, right? Mm. The candy lady in the neighborhood, the ice cream. Oh, maybe that was just my neighborhood. Yeah. You know, like that's who we are and who we have been. But recognize that to bring these things to scale, we need to invest in our people. We need to see their ideas as promising. And those of us who are in a position where we might have access to a little bit of power, a little bit of money, whatever, leverage it to support them.
McDonald's is not new to chicken. So maybe stop questioning their chicken cred and get your hands on the McCrispy. Juicy fried chicken, buttery bun, unmatched pickle to chicken ratio. Yeah, they know what they're doing. In fact, we can honestly say they're not new to chicken. They're true to chicken. The McCrispy. Only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
You know, Black media is really its own unique space because the Black existence, particularly in America, is its own unique space. And even as we are watching that erasure and the legislative effort to undermine the necessity to be literally intentional with making spaces for Black people in a country that was very intentional and continues to be intentional in keeping Black people out of spaces of equity, we know that Black media has to be on top of that. We know that Black media has to be able to speak to our unique existence. So when it comes to the next generation of influential Black voices, I'm really happy to see that they can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black Stories, Black Truths. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story, but now they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. So hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcasts that center Black voices. It's NPR Noir. Turn on NPR today and hear a range of voices as varied, nuanced, and bliggity black as the country we reflect. Stories should never be about us without us. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
What would you say are some ways that the system as it exists in the last year, what would you say are some ways that are draining Black educators, specifically Black educators? I know that you work with Black, Brown, and Indigenous, but I would love to hear specifically Black educators, because I think that, I mean, I can theorize, but I'd love to hear from the what you're hearing.
Yeah, so one of our many programs, we run like five different programs at Surge, is the Black Principals Network. And this is a network of hundreds of Black principals from across the country. Wow. So we hear all the stories.
They're getting out of tea,
all the stories. And, you know, what I will say is we just had a graduation celebration for a cohort of 20 principals from across the country.
Nice.
And to hear them say, you know, but for this experience pouring into mm-hmm. me, I might not have stayed in this profession. And it's because I'm being asked to be so many things. Like I'm holding in the middle of a space where we are being attacked about what we teach, what we say. Mm-hmm. We're also dealing with students who may be far behind because of COVID, all these things.
Right.
So I'm carrying the baggage of an instructional leader of trying to do everything that I can to ensure that my young people thrive. I'm carrying the emotional baggage of an entire team or school full of leaders mm-hmm. that need me to hold them up and pour into them.
Morale.
I'm also a member of this broader community that is being like, we're fighting stuff left and right.
Yeah.
And like, who's pouring into me? Like, at some point, I just don't have any more to give. So for us, it is my greatest pride to be able to create a community of care for people who feel so invisible, who are frankly doing God's work, in my opinion. Like they are, whatever you want to call your supreme deity, like they are doing the work that the future of our democracy is dependent upon the education of our young people, full stop to me. And the people who are holding that up, who's holding them up? And if it's not us, then shame on us.
To that point, though, like we hear about things like book banning, this bullshit about CRT.
People don't even know what that means, by the way.
Can you please explain? I mean, we are going to have Kimberly Crenshaw actually on the podcast.
Okay,
so
Kimberly Crenshaw,
but,
here's
the thing, though. She's going to be explaining what CRT is in its actual form.
Yeah.
Can you explain what people think CRT is and why Black teachers are so exhausted by this actual bullshit?
Oh my goodness, you about to make me come up out of my professionalism.
Good.
I've been here. But so right now, it's like anything that you say about race, anything that you say that is not even provocative, it's just truth and history is labeled as critical race theory. I legitimately was talking to a colleague who runs an organization that actually invests in districts and schools to help leaders create space of comfort for their staff, like to build morale.
Yeah.
Benign. It sounds really benign, right?
Yeah.
But he gave me an example of being booted out of two different districts because people came to board meetings and said, oh, this is CRT, this is da-da-da, simply because they actually even mention race. The fact that they mention data that you can look up anywhere that says that Black boys and girls are disproportionately punished for the same infractions at higher rates for things like, you know, talking out of turn, doing whatever. Like, there's all kind of data that supports this. And knowing this as an educator is actually really important. It is You would think. But when you have people and they have scripts, they are prepared and are prepared to target anything that, this is my personal opinion. I'm going to take off my surge hat for a minute and just say, this is my I feel that so many people don't want us to know our truth, because if our young people don't know the truth, if their young people don't know the truth, then we will undoubtedly repeat the same things. Like,
yes, it's there won't be change.
There will not be change. And in fact, we will continue to backslide into—
As we are continuing to do.
Yes, we talked about that earlier. So for me, I think we are being hit on so many different sides. Like, our educators are having to fight that nonsense. So, you know, people want to keep you busy fighting some bullshit so that you avoid the other real stuff that's happening over here, right? So it's like I've said before, and I've said this publicly, I've been involved in some education conversations that wanted to pit Black and brown folks against each other. Mm. And it's like, y'all realize that that's part of the plan, right? That
divide and conquer!
It has been happening for a long time. So if we can sit over here and fight over these scraps, then we'll be oblivious to like the real work that's happening to undermine what we know our young people and communities need.
I mean, I theorize that this really came out of seeing people come together for the Black Lives Matter movement.
Oh, absolutely.
And they were like, oh shit, they're waking up. So we need to actually get very organized to quiet them. And that's where you get this Moms of Liberty bullshit. That's where you get the banning of the books. That's where you get the co-opting of the word woke, the co-opting of CRT. I'm wondering though, I don't think a lot of us who are necessarily not in the education system, I think some of us kind of, maybe we like idealize that because it's an education space that folks are operating from like a place of, I don't know, ethics, of principles, of values, because like, you know better, you do better.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's just not it.
I mean, here's the thing. And I'm saying this as a person who, you know, I started my career in a corporate background.
Yeah.
I came into education. I came into it super naive. Mm-hmm. I came in as a person.
Did you come
like,
in thinking that way?
Yes. I legitimately came in saying, okay, education without access to a high quality public education, but for that, I wouldn't be in the position that I'm in.
Fair.
And I know I'm not a unicorn. Forget, you know, other people say, like, I'm not. Sorry, Tiffany Haddish. But
hey, Tiff.
I'm not exceptional in that way. And I want to be a part of actually creating systems that allow our young people to all see themselves as that.
Like, right.
So,
I noble then, cause.
Right. I then get into this space, and one of the first things that I saw, that's why Surge exists, that was absolutely surprising and it haunted me.
Ooh.
Was the same phenomenon that I had seen in corporate spaces of the higher you go in organizations, the whiter and more elite they get.
Mm-hmm.
That same thing happening in nonprofits and education, which blew me away. Because I'm like, well, how is that so? If all of these babies and families that we serve are Black and brown people, and a lot of your folks won't know that 20% of the teacher population in this country identifies as Black and brown folks, even though the majority of students are like over 54% as of. So
over 54% of the student body of America is Black and brown
US
students.
K-12 and 20% of teachers.
Is this the where the realities of seeing whiteness diminish?
Yes. So we could get into Brown v. Board and the role that actually played in nearly 4,000 Black teachers.
Well, you know what? Shout out to all you Black men who be talking shit about Black women and you found you a white lady. You unwittingly were a part of a movement. So good job. you made more brown babies.
But the numbers actually even get more dire when you get to like CEO roles. So in like CEO superintendent positions, 6% of those folks identify as Black or brown folks.
Six.
So Surge was really born in response to that, to say this is crazy. Yeah. It is crazy that we have a majority Black and brown population in our schools, in the, and the people who are serving them. And here's the thing. I don't believe that they're all evil people. Like, you might be very well-meaning and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But it should give us all pause if the people that we're serving are not represented in the places where we're deciding their fates.
Now, see, that's too much like right. Now, you know... Because you know that that would require self-awareness.
Yeah.
And, you know, the reality that I notice, one of the things that just kind of blows my mind about just race in America is honestly just the ground, on a ground level, the lack of self-awareness that I see around just whiteness.
Yeah.
Like even just driving through a parking lot and like Daphne, move. Like I'm like, there's cars here, but it's just like, and I don't see that. And I'm not even making a broad strokes argument here, y'all. I literally am like, on a regular basis, why are there always white people walking in the street without any care or like consciousness about their bodies? Because they feel so safe. They feel so protected.
Do you know, so this is a bit off topic, but we just girlfriends having a chat here.
Yes, we are.
So I'm going to say my partner, my husband, is a Middle Eastern man. And he and I have often talked about the different ways in which we walk through the world. Mm. So first of all, I did not know before we started dating, because I had only been with Black people, I didn't know all these things.
Wait, hold up. So where did you find him?
On Tinder, girl. Yes.
Old school. When Tinder was for people that actually wanted to date.
This was 2014. I mean, now, to be real clear, I was just having fun. He was my second... Just to be clear. He was my second date of the night. I told him that he could join the rotation, but there were no starting spots on the roster. But... yet, here we are 9 years later. So, but I did not, one, realize that as a Lebanese man, according to our census, he is white. That is insane.
I have another question then, because what made you swipe right on him?
Because
you said you've never...
Yes, he was attractive.
All right. Shout out to Lebanon.
And whatever he had written was just dope. It was like,
oh,
it
like
was
his
my kind of humor.
It wasn't just him with a tiger?
Yeah.
Because that was a big thing on Tinder. Big!
And so I was like, oh, I think I could, and then just banter all the things.
Nice.
Okay. But what we talked about is, one, like, he and I walk through the world very differently. Now, you've seen my husband, like, ain't nothing about him white. You don't see him and see a white man. But he's like, can you believe that according to your census, because he came here as a refugee, he had to go through all the things.
Uh-huh.
It's like, I'm supposed to check white because that's how they keep white as the majority, as we keep changing the...
There was a whole reason. There's a whole thing for that.
There's a whole thing for that.
Again, but that's another podcast episode.
But to your point about how we walk through the world, he's like, you walk through the world and feel invisible as a Black woman. Like people don't see you. Like people will walk into you on a sidewalk.
Man.
Like they don't see you. We've all experienced
I almost
this.
Had a full fight on a Delta Airlines flight off of this. Like, do you not see me?
And he's like, I have the opposite issue. Post 9/11 in this country, people are hyper aware of everywhere I am. Like, if we want to fly Southwest and not have anybody sit by us, then he can sit there and I can sit like in the window. Ain't nobody sitting on that row. Like, they're like,
that's kind of a life hack. Just saying. That's definitely lemons and lemonade.
But, and it's so real. But to your point, and you know, I try. In our work, I don't center whiteness. I've said earlier, like, it's somebody else's ministry to, you know, pour into white folks and help educate them and all of that. That's not what I do.
No.
But it is somebody's ministry to do it, and it's great. But I think it's important, at least for me, I didn't recognize the different ways in which whiteness and all that encompasses that, even though we know it's not even really a thing, impacts those of us of color in so many ways. Like, we tired. Like,
How
can you not be thinking all the time, like, people don't see me on the street and I have to make myself hyper visible? I have to take up space in order to just be.
Hey,
McDonald's is not new to chicken. So maybe stop questioning their chicken cred and get your hands on the McCrispy, juicy fried chicken, buttery bun, unmatched pickle to chicken ratio. Yeah, they know what they're doing. In fact, we can honestly say they're not new to chicken. They're true to chicken. The McCrispy. Only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
You know, Black media is really its own unique space because the Black existence, particularly in America, is its own unique space. And even as we are watching that erasure and the legislative effort to undermine the necessity to be literally intentional with making spaces for Black people in a country that was very intentional and continues to be intentional in keeping Black people out of spaces of equity, we know that Black media has to be on top of that. We know that Black media has to be able to speak to our unique existence. So when it comes to the next generation of influential Black voices, I'm really happy to see that they can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black stories, Black truths. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story, but now they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. So hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcasts that center Black voices. It's NPR Noir. Turn on NPR today and hear a range of voices as varied, nuanced, and bliggity Black as the country we reflect. Stories should never be about us without us. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
Even just the consciousness that, like, if you're walking on a sidewalk and some white people are walking on a sidewalk, I know Black people, come on, admit to yourselves. You'd be like, let's see if they're going to move.
Oh, absolutely. Every time. Are you going to move?
Are you going to
expect me to move?
Right. And then are we going to both move?
Yes. Yes.
I'm fine with us both moving.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if you saw, like, the video kind of went viral where they were like, this is white people when you're hiking.
Oh, yeah.
And it would show, like, white people be like, it's great over there. And it's like in that, like there's particular spaces with a particular kind of white people where you feel like it's not that. But just in general, the hyper awareness is incredibly tiring, exhausting. I can't imagine being an educator and having that hyper awareness as well as being also, you also have to be hyper aware of the children.
Yes.
But before we even get to that, I want to ask you, you have spoken in this interview just about you as a leader. You've always been a leader. You've always been the person who says the thing. So many women, particularly Black women, are like, I cannot meet somebody as this person that really takes me in this way. Mm-hmm. What do you think is unique about your husband that he is able to receive all of that? Yeah. I mean, you've spoken very highly of him, so I'm assuming we're still good. Okay.
Yeah, we're good.
So that they,
he gets on my nerves every day, just to be clear, because that's relationships. But
which is why I don't think I'm going to do another one. I don't. I think I need a good 5-year respite.
By the way, this is number two, the bite number two at this apple. He's husband number two for me. So
I see.
I mean, he says to stop counting because he's the last
one. He's like, no, can I just be the last one? But like, what is it about him though that you think allows him, because you have to be outside of patriarchy to be able to receive a woman like you.
Yeah. And I will say this is, and I'm not saying this unique, this is not unique about him as a man who is non-Black, because I was with Black men my entire life before him. And this was also not the case in many other relationships. Mm-hmm. So I think a couple different things. And without, because I don't want to start crying up in here. Like
everyone cries on this show.
I've seen some of them, but some people make it through to the end. I want to be one of those. But there is something about his journey and his story as a refugee and from a culture that really elevates women. Like the mom is, the woman is the center of the thing. In many ways, the matriarch is the center of the thing. So in many ways, he has felt sort of judged in his family because he made the decision to leave to go to another place to go to college. Like, that's not what they do culturally. Like, you stay with your mom until you get married, like, and whatever. And so I think his experience in that culture, but as well as a refugee and just feeling like an outsider in so many spaces. Mm-hmm. He went from Lebanon to Dubai, Dubai to Canada, Canada to Texas.
That's elite. At what point did he go to therapy?
Girl, that was, by the way, a huge, when we started dating, I was like, I think you need some therapy.
That's all trauma.
Yeah. And it didn't work until we had our daughter, interestingly enough.
You mean it didn't work that he didn't go, or
he didn't go? Okay. Like, he would always say like, I don't know, I don't know. And I think having a child, particularly a girl child, I don't know if you would agree with me, George. Like, was the impetus to say, I want to show up as a good man. Like, I want to be a good, he's always been a good man to me, but a good father.
You know what a homeboy of mine said recently? He was like, a lot of men don't even know how to be a good person. Let alone a good man. He was like, so much of it is actually first just being a good person.
Yes.
And then being a good man.
Yeah.
And so, like, I feel like that's what you're describing. Like, he was a good person with you.
Yeah.
But then it's like, how do I become like a good man? Like, which encompasses being a father and being like soulfully connected.
Yeah. Which also means I got to deal with the trauma. Like,
that's the only, actually, that's all that means.
Yeah. I got to actually do the work. I will never forget. Sorry, you asking about him. I'm going to tell you about me just because I think people need to hear it. Like, in my first marriage, I will never forget the eye-opening moment that I had in therapy. I had been, you know, we had done years of couples therapy, all this stuff, And I realized I've been wasting all this time trying to fix him or trying to fix this thing when ultimately my shit is broken. And if I don't fix that, then I'm not going to show up well for anybody. Like, I'm not going to be able
to. The epiphany, yo. That's like really the epiphany.
But it's hard, like, especially for, I'm going to call, you know, I'm not projecting onto you, but there's a whole group of us insecure overachievers out there where we've been amazing in life. We've been great students. We've been this, we've been leaders, all this stuff. And to have to like look in the mirror and say, there's actually shit about myself I do not like. Right?
Yep.
Right?
I mean, that's how I started in therapy. I literally started going to therapy because one person too many told me people don't like you. And I was like, okay, I gotta go talk about this because I don't know. I just feel like that's such a huge thing that a lot of women who are overachieving leaders don't want to face because they think it's going to undermine their ability to overachieve and lead.
Yeah. And it's done the exact opposite. Like I say, and I say this with all love to my ex-husband because I wish him well. He's great. He was not a horrible human being by any stretch of the imagination.
Good for
you. But Serge would not exist if I hadn't gotten divorced, period. I wouldn't have been able to live into the thing that was my calling and my purpose because I was spending so much time trying to be a smaller version of myself in order to make something work.
Why? What?
The answer is always the patriarchy.
The patriarchy. I mean, it's just because honestly, like the whole being a smaller person, you know, it aligns with even what we're talking about with these educators, right? Because when you're in these spaces that are so white dominant, like that are so systemic, you naturally become smaller out of just safety, right?
Well, 'cause you've been told that you take up too much space. And when you do take up space, we've all heard the thing. Oh, you're
make sure to listen to my episode, Side Effects of Too Much. Carry on.
Yes. You're intimidating. You're this, you're that, you know, all.
You're extra.
Right. Oh, I've been extra my whole life.
Let me tell you something. My sophomore year of college, I was in a suite. When I walked up to the door, my name was not on the door, but everybody else's name was on the door. And I literally walked up with my ex, Devon, and he looked over and my name had been strewn to the side. So I already knew, what? Like, all right, well, we about to walk into...
What were you walking into? Okay.
BS, right? All right. So I'm in this suite with, like, my actual roommate, she was fine, but everybody else had, like, issues with me, and I did not know what these issues were. And so one night, I was like, okay, I would like to schedule for us on a Friday night to, like, take tequila shots, and each of y'all could tell me what your issue is with me. And literally, 5 out of the 6 the issue was, well, you're just really extra. You're just too much. Mm. You're a show off. Mm. You're a lot. Mm. And I was just like, I mean, in like what way? Because I'm flat chested. So my booty ain't poking out. Like I'm barely hitting puberty at this point. So I'm still like, what is it? Well, you know, you doing cartwheels. Like there's a field. Why wouldn't I do cartwheels? Like this makes sense to me. But like it dawned on me in that moment, like, oh, if you want them to like you, like you're going to have to like be smaller. Yeah. And I spent a long time being that because extra.
Yeah. Did you find your people? Have you found your people?
Oh, yeah. I definitely found my people. They're extra too.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what you realize. Like, so I'm not going to get all into
And one of those became like my people.
Yeah.
Hey, Em! Yes.
Because the thing is, so I went, talk through a strengths-based lens because I do strengths coaching.
Strengths. Okay. Strength. I was like, string space. What is that? Is that a thread? What does that mean? Okay.
Sorry, that's my Alabama coming out. People see you and experience you through the lens of their own strengths, right?
Yes.
So
yes.
You're extra because that would be so uncomfortable for me, right? Like that would be so, your willingness to do cartwheels and the thing, like I would be embarrassed as hell. So you should be embarrassed too. Like just understanding that,
my
mom used to always say, RIP Wanda, like that woman, she would always say, it ain't about you. She would say that all the time. Mm-hmm. It ain't about you. It's not about you. I hated hearing that as a kid. I thought that was the ultimate adult cop-out.
Yeah,
like, I was
what
do you mean? But I now understand, like, this was before reading Ruiz's 4 Agreements.
It's over there.
She is like, what she was saying is like, don't take shit personal. Like, like, most of what happens to you, even for you, is often not even about you. And like, it just helps. And I feel like I could write a book of all the wisdom that I got. I lost my mom when I was 23.
Sorry to hear that.
Thank you. And her best friend once said to me, maybe a year after her death, you know, my mom was disabled my entire life. And she said, your mom was so tired. And she said she was going to let go when she knew that you were ready. Mm. Now, imagine hearing this at 23, 24. I was like, that math ain't math. And I'm not ready. Like, I'm still, you know. But I think about so much of what she poured into me that has helped me show up in spaces in the way, like, that whole, like...
I mean, 3 years later, you were 26 telling people, go fuck yourself.
Exactly. And it's because, like, of just her stuff that she had poured into me. And so I really do believe, like, and we've gone, you know, in lots of places with this, but we can't lead people to their breakthrough from our brokenness. So unless...
Say it again.
I said, we cannot lead other people to their breakthrough from our brokenness.
That's, you putting that on a mug?
Like, I should.
Because that right there is so profound. I think that so many people don't, first of all, so many people don't even feel like they need to help others and lead, right? But they fear their brokenness, not realizing that like there's so much strength.
Yes. And that's particularly to bring it back to our educators. The reason that our work that and the heart and spirit part of our work is so important is because if you don't do that, like you can learn all the skills and all that stuff, but you are inevitably going to have to fight against something.
Yeah.
Something is going to come against you. And if you haven't actually done the work to deal with the limiting beliefs and all the other bullshit that we carry, then you won't be able to withstand that. So what we're trying to do is actually create, as I said earlier, this container of care, pour in our people so that they can sustain over time. It's not just about get that next promotion. position, be the next superintendent. Like, yes, we want all of that. But we want you to actually be able to thrive when you're there. And that means you got to have community and you have to have done your work so that you can support other people in doing theirs.
Well, y'all can support me by going to my Patreon, the Amandaverse, where we are going to be answering your questions. You know, we do this every show. We got our bonus questions, and Carmita Simon of the Search Institute will be answering questions like, what jobs do people tend to get after leaving teaching? Now, we did a whole educator series here on the show with a number of educators that we interviewed, you know, David Johns, Ernest Krim, shout out to Valencia.
You had all the people.
Mm-hmm. But so many of them have left educating.
Yeah.
And for various reasons, but still all very valid reasons related to the system.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I would definitely want to get into that. We're also going to talk about what role do teachers have in forming the curriculum? So I think something that's missing for a lot of us is actually how the system works. So we'll be talking about those things and more. So head on over to the Patreon, Amanda Seals, or you can go to the Amandaverse. It's a universe of Amanda. .com.
McDonald's is not new to chicken. So maybe stop questioning their chicken cred and get your hands on the McCrispy. Juicy fried chicken, buttery bun, unmatched pickle to chicken ratio. Yeah, they know what they're doing. In fact, we can honestly say they're not new to chicken. They're true to chicken. The McCrispy. Only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
You know, Black media is really its own unique space because the Black existence, particularly in America, is its own unique space. And even as we are watching that erasure and the legislative effort to undermine the necessity to be literally intentional with making spaces for Black people in a country that was very intentional and continues to be intentional in keeping Black people out of spaces of equity, we know that Black media has to be on top of that. We know that Black media has to be able to speak to our unique existence. So when it comes to the next generation of influential Black voices, I'm really happy to see that they can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black stories, Black truths. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story, but now they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. So hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcasts that center Black voices. It's NPR Noir. Turn on NPR today and hear a range of voices as varied, nuanced, and bliggity Black as the country we reflect. Stories should never be about us without us. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
The last dose.
Well, anytime we have anyone from education, we get educated. You know, I think so many folks are, one, just very scared, me included, of how the repercussions of the shift in education in this country are going to play out.
Yeah.
Like, on top of us going through a pandemic, right? On top of just the world itself just being in chaos and mayhem, the actual, like, concerted effort to attack the people through education, we know that that has been a very effective tool.
Yeah.
We know that that is not by, like, accident. Like, Black people, like, we were not allowed to read by punishable by death.
Right.
Like, that's so, like, this is not, like, you know? And so, like, where do you feel like your heart lies in in this time? Because when you tell me that you have educators who have said to you, like, I was about to quit, I was about to go start a scuba, I was about to start a scuba shop in Australia, but Carmita and the Surge kept me in it because y'all poured into them. What or how are you poured into to keep doing this work at a time where it does feel so exhaustive, but yet it's so essential?
Yeah. So I'm going to say two things. One is I'm a studier of history. This is not the first time they've come for us.
Girl. Yeah, I know what you're about to say.
You know? Mm-hmm. And I really believe the fight changes mm-hmm. over time. Mm-hmm. It shifts. The actors change. But what's underneath it is always the same,
which is
a real questioning or disbelief in our humanity and our ability to just be and be free.
I would challenge you on that. I think it's actually a disbelief in their humanity.
Oh, okay. Yes, yes. It's like the fine line between arrogance and insecurity. And
bingo.
Yes.
I think it's actually they don't believe in themselves. And so their own ability to feel valuable is tied
to, yes, undermining our, yes. And as a studier of history and just a call me whatever, believer in my people.
Okay.
We meet the fight every single time.
We do.
Like every time. Now there's going to be casualties along the way.
Yeah.
And all
coons.
Of that.
There's going to be coons. There's going to be coons too. I guess those can be casualties of a certain kind too.
All of that. Because the way you infiltrate a people is to find an area of weakness.
Yes.
And I don't even have to do the work if I have you do my work for me. We could go through all of that. But I do have this unwavering belief in our ability to step up to any moment. And often it comes acting outside of the system.
Yes.
So you have people, I was just in conversation over the last week with a number of people who are starting their own school programs.
Okay.
Like outside, like, because what are we going to do? We're not going to bow to us. It's like, okay. So there's this professor, mispronounce her name, but she did this work. I think it's Badalania or something like that. Sorry, lady. But what she talked about are the three actors that are always present in any major social justice movement that has been successful. And she says they are activators, innovators, and orchestrators. I call innovators infiltrators, in my view.
Okay.
And in our movements, you got to have the people who are outside pushing the system, saying like, hell no, we won't go, whatever. Like, you got to have those people. Because the system is not going to change inertia. Like, we're not going to change unless
it's not going to change just because it should.
Right. But you also have to have infiltrators. You have to have people within those systems who are like, I'm in here to actually change the thing.
A spook by the door.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. I just suggested that book to someone just this weekend.
Samuel Bainley.
But then you've also got to have orchestrators, people who will use their power outside of the system, whether it was Harry Belafonte and civil rights and like, I'm going to give you a plane or put you up in a motel you or Ella Baker or whatever. You know, it's like you've got to have those people too. So I see this as just as one of those moments. Like we have to recognize that there are people in all of those places. Now, what we can't do is vilify and demonize people because they choose to fight from a different place than me. So like if I'm an agitator, I can't actually vilify you because you choose to be in the system and try to change.
Yeah, as long as you are part of
the same page. Okay. Yeah, like, we gotta be on the same page, right? We're all fighting for the same thing. We're just choosing to do it in different ways.
Multi-pronged approach.
And I believe in our people and our ability to do that. Like, it's not going to happen overnight, but I see instances, because I'm talking to leaders all the time, they are doing it right now. I was just talking to a sister who's like, hey, I'm starting, you know, this school in Kansas City. It's off the grid. Like, we're specifically looking to support students who have been left out of systems, who have special needs and da-da-da-da-da. I'm talking to another brother who's like, okay, I'm going to keep doing this thing within the system, but then I'm also starting my own organization over here that's going to do like, and that's what we do.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't be able to get up and do this work every day if I didn't believe in our innate ability to tackle whatever comes at us. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't make, I mean, that doesn't stop me from being frustrated and mad as hell at all the BS. Like, what, we can't say Rosa Parks was black in Florida? Okay, that's, you know, whatever, right. Like all the craziness. But I have to see the craziness for what it is, and I have to double down on my investment in my people, because I think that's where our liberation is going to come.
Well, where can people get more information on the Surge Institute?
You can find us on all the socials. It's our website is surgeinstitute.org, but we have a Surge Institute YouTube channel, IG, we're Surge Institute, all the things, LinkedIn. There are opportunities for you to find out more about the work that we do, but also volunteer, get our newsletter, financially support, please. And if you are an educator, we're currently in 7 different markets across the country, but are consistently growing. Mm-hmm. So follow us, and hopefully we'll be in a city near you and have an opportunity for you to join our family.
There you have it, y'all. Surge on.
Surge on. Soar with Surge.
Soar with Surge. Thank you, Carmita.
Thank you.
McDonald's is not new to chicken. So maybe stop questioning their chicken cred and get your hands on the McCrispy. Juicy fried chicken, buttery bun, unmatched pickle to chicken ratio. Yeah, they know what they're doing. In fact, we can honestly say they're not new to chicken. They're true to chicken. The McCrispy. Only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
You know, Black media is really its own unique space, because the Black existence, particularly in America, is its own unique space. And even as we are watching that erasure and the legislative effort to undermine the necessity to be literally intentional with making spaces for Black people in a country that was very intentional and continues to be intentional in keeping Black people out of spaces of equity, we know that Black media has to be on top of that. We know that Black media has to be able to speak to our unique existence. So when it comes to the next generation of influential Black voices, I'm really happy to see that they can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black Stories, Black Truths. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story, but now they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. So hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcasts that center Black voices. It's NPR Noir. Turn on NPR today and hear a range of voices as varied, nuanced, and bliggity Black as the country we reflect. Stories should never be about us without us. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.